It's time to head out on the front porch on KFRM. Grab your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation on the front porch.
Welcome to On the Front Porch. I'm Tamara Wallace, and I'm visiting with author Beth Hanley Adams, writing under her maiden name of Beth Lynn White for On the Front Porch. She wrote a book titled Captured, The True Account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne while living in Wisconsin, but currently resides in Tombstone, Arizona. The book is a biography about her cousin Sarah White, whom was captured by the Cheyenne Warriors near Concordia, Kansas, along with Sarah's fellow captive, Anna Brewster Morgan from Delphus, Kansas. Welcome to On the Front Porch.
Well, thank you so much for reaching out and for arranging this. I'm truly honored, and I thank you very much.
Beth Lynn, let's start at the beginning. Tell us about your childhood.
Well, I grew up in an old rock house in a very small village called Fayette in Lafayette County, Wisconsin, with my parents and my brother. And the village consisted of family on both sides, so it was a really safe place to be raised. I lived next door to our Methodist church where I attended Sunday and Bible school. I absolutely loved it. I have great memories of that. My brother Dwayne and I played with the other neighborhood kids, and many of whom were our cousins. And so I had an awesome childhood. And actually, I didn't put two and two together until I, you know, began writing the book. But I grew up about 20 to 30 miles away from where Sarah grew up in Elk Grove. And I just never, you know, that didn't register with me growing up, even though I knew about her.
Did you have a dream job as a kid?
Well, I've always been a creative-minded person. Ever since I was little, I was always, you know, coloring and coloring books or drawing, and I always wanted to be an artist. At one time, though, I entertained wanting to be a veterinarian because I adore animals. But as I got older, I realized that my math and science skills left a lot to be desired for that type of vocation. So I went back and focused on art.
Tell me about high school.
Well, I attended Darlington High School in Darlington, Wisconsin from 1980 to 84. I loved it at the time, but I may have some differing thoughts now, you know, when you look back. But, you know, generally it was all good. I had my group of friends in my grade, and there was a few seniors that I was close to, had a good relationship with. I got involved with gymnastics my freshman year. I froze during a floor mat routine, and that was it. It was like, I'm not good at this, and I chose not to continue with that. I was in a ski club my freshman year, so that was a lot of fun. The numbers weren't there to continue it later on. I was involved in forensics. And also with the plays and musicals that they would put on, I would basically be in the background painting scenery or doing the makeup on the other actors. I did have a part in the play Harvey as Aunt Ethel Chauvenet, which I enjoyed very much, and the rehearsals and the fun that went along with that. I would say that those times are my favorites that I can recollect. And, of course, you know, outside of high school, I was fortunate to be able to attend some rock concerts for my favorite singers like Adamant and Duran Duran.
Did you have a favorite coach or teacher in high school?
I did. There were several teachers. I really liked my English teacher, Mr. Rasmussen, and he's passed away. He always made the class fun, you know, like when he was trying to explain a scenario about something that required to, like a male and a female, he'd always call them Joe Cool and Betty Lou. That was just, just the way he was. And also my social studies teacher, Mr. Wilkinson, who's also passed on, was great as well because he would tell you fun facts about who or what you were studying at the time. Like the thing that I remember even to this day is the fact that Abraham Lincoln's voice was really high-pitched. And my all-time favorite teacher was Greg Bykowski. He taught the art class. And also I worked under him doing the play, scenery, and everything. But he taught me so much, even after high school, because I could always call him and pick his brain about how to go about doing something. So he was my mentor in so many ways, and I hold him in the highest of regards.
What did you do after high school?
I graduated in May of 1984, and I had plans of attending University of Wisconsin in Green Bay. It was really hard because my dad passed away that July, the day before his birthday. So it was really difficult leaving my mom behind alone. My brother attended UW-Green Bay, so I had him while I was there. I went to college for fine art and communications, and I had some awesome roommates. They helped bring me out of my shell because they were older. You know, they were like sophomores and juniors and seniors. I also had my group of friends. There was Arthur, Robin, and Lee. And the one who was very special to me was Lee. He always knew when I was missing my dad and always seemed to show up when I needed somebody. He was my best friend, and unfortunately, he passed away May 4th of 1985 due to cancer complications at the age of 18. But in that short amount of time, in the few months I knew him, he impacted my life so much. I found out when I got back from London, I went to London during my January interim of my freshman year, and it was after I returned home that I found out that he was in the hospital. I did forge a roommate with my London roommate, Sue Tipler, and that is still very, very strong today. I would say London, for me, was a life-changing event. The 1980s was so much fun anyway, but going to London, where a lot of my favorite singers originated from, it was just a total blast. It was a huge highlight in my life that I still look back on. I met my first husband there, and he proposed on our second date over there, so that was quite different. I just kind of, like, jumped in into a relationship. But everything, you know, is for a reason.
What were you doing over at London? Were you doing a particular study?
Well, it was called the Arts London, and there was different groups that went. So there was the arts, and then there was kind of like a sociology group, and there was a couple of different professors that we were underneath there from UW-Green Bay. Richard Sherrell for the arts and Harvey Kay for the sociology. I had always wanted to go to London, and hey, I mean, come on, you know, my student financial aid paid for it, and I got 3 credits, and I got to hang around in London for 28 days, you know, and experience the culture and go to a lot of the historical places, you know, I mean, and we got access into areas of those places as a group that you wouldn't get to as a normal tourist. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, the architecture and just the whole art scene, it was really just so much fun. But then I was all about having fun too. So, you know, my roommate and I would go out dancing a lot and just have a good time.
Did you work in college back in Wisconsin?
I did. I needed to have some income, so they had work-study jobs, which they still do in colleges today. And my first job, I worked at the Lawton Art Gallery on campus, and that taught me the skills of learning how to install art exhibitions. And then my sophomore year, I actually worked as a gallery guard for a different person. So when there was performances going on in the theater, I would come and open up the art gallery for people to see the exhibits prior to the performance, and then during the intermission, and then afterwards for a while. So that was basically my job my sophomore year there. After that, I didn't really have to work too much.
Did you do any writing about art?
No. I had no inclination yet to be a writer at all. It was all about art for me. I was still in college when I got married. So I got married in July of 86 mm-hmm. to the man that I met in Ireland, Patrick Hanley. After I graduated in December of 88, I set about just getting a regular job, and I got a job at Green Bay Blueprints and Art Supply. So I would work in the art departments and assist customers, and eventually became head of the graphics, where I would do all the ordering for those products. But we decided to relocate in September of 1990 down to Shelbsburg because it was closer to family in Wisconsin. We raised calves and chickens. Eventually we had our children, 3 children. But it was in 1997 when things kind of went wrong. Alcoholism took over for him, and he committed suicide, leaving me with 3 little children, no job, and highly in debt because he had a semi and a semi-trailer and all those bills for that. But with the help of my mom, I raised the kids. I managed to be able to get things taken care of as much as I could with the debt. And then I filed bankruptcy, of course, because there was no other alternative. When I was 36, I did have another child. So I have 4 children, Tig, Ashlyn, Patrick, and Aspen, and they're all grown. And my oldest, Tig, is married. His wife's name is Kayla. They have 2 daughters and a son, Deersha, Neve, and Gerard, and they live near Tampa, Florida. Ashlyn is married to Brian and lives in Platteville, Wisconsin, and Patrick and Aspen both live in Green Bay.
What books did you enjoy reading while you were a kid?
Oh, as a kid, Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys were big. There was one book that I read over and over and over again, and I do not recall who wrote it, but it was called The Ghost in the Swing. And I also read the Laura Ingalls Wilder series.
And in college, did you continue reading as well?
I did. I kind of turned to romance. I liked escapism, you know, being that, you know, you're studying and you're having to read the school stuff. I just kind of wanted to escape. And so there was a lot of different, like, historical romance that I enjoyed. Later on, as I continued reading them, I have the entire Highlander series by Karen Murray Moaning, which I really enjoy, as well as Karen Kay. She had a lot of Native American. That's her genre that she writes romance in.
So were those the books that or authors that inspired you to become a writer?
Yeah, I, you know, after reading a lot of romances, I kept thinking to myself, you know, I could do this. I just started getting the itch, like, you know, I want to try to make up my own story and see how it goes. I ended up going and meeting Karen at a book signing in Madison, Wisconsin. Very nice lady. We've since become friends. She was very encouraging and gave me some interesting insights about writing and your characters, like, they'll nag at you to get their story done, and it's just, and it sounds like you're crazy, but it happens. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of agreed with her, like, oh, interesting, you know, but I found out that it's very true because they become real to you in your head, you know, as you're writing the story, and they do, they take on kind of a life of their own and dictate how they want the story to go. Mm-hmm. And if you're not working on it, they're like, hey, when are you going to work on mine, you know, my life, that sort of thing. And it does. It sounds like you're totally psycho, but it happens. But I also like to read real history, especially since relocating to Tombstone, Arizona. I like to read about the places and the people here that made up this town. But I've always liked the history, you know, the ancient history of, like, Ireland and Scotland and England as well. I've gotten into, in the past few years, some more self-empowerment types of reading. A big one is The Success Intersection by Pat Williams. Then there's Matt Tomey, who has a series of books, Created to Thrive and Unlocking the Heart of the Artist, that really resonated with me. So I pick those up and you know, leaf through and pick out certain points just to help keep me focused and interested in what I'm doing.
It was interesting to see what kind of books you liked. And
well, I don't read romances right now when I'm working on one because I don't want to be influenced. You know what I mean? It's so easy to glean something from somebody else's book, and I don't want to be guilty of plagiarism. So, you know, that influence. And I was accused of that with my first novel by a review, and I was just like, you didn't read far enough. There's a lot of time travel element books out there, you know? So it kind of, you know, you got to learn to have a tough skin, too, with reviews, because there's always going to be somebody that isn't pleased or whatever.
I'm Tamara Wallace talking with Beth Lynn White from Tombstone, Arizona. We have learned about her growing up. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we will learn about the process of writing her book, Captured, The True Account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne. Back on the front porch, I'm Tamara Wallace visiting with Beth Lynn White from Tombstone, Arizona. We have learned about her growing up. Now we are going to learn about the process of writing her book, Captured, The True Account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne. Beth Lynn, tell us how you got started in your career as an author.
You know, as I said in the previous section, after reading a lot of romances, I was like, I could do this. And so I began writing in notebooks like 20 or more years ago. Just making stories up. They're all in varied stages of completion. But my first one that I began writing, it began after I had a past life regression. And I wrote a book on that, like, past life experience. It's still unfinished. It needs a lot of tweaking, but I do have, you know, plans on completing that. It just needs some help at this point. I wrote a romance that I published in 2018 prior to the one about Sarah. And it's called The Beast of Tapley Woods. And, you know, the thing about writing anything, like, when you have a setting, you got to have your setting. So you need to do research on where the setting is, especially if it's a historical one. So mine usually all do have a historical or a mythological aspect to it. So there's the historical settings are involved. So you have to know the culture and the socioeconomic climate of the era, as well as any historical events that take place which impacted those at the time, because they become almost like a character themselves because they impact your character's lives and where your story goes. In regards to Sarah's story, as I call it, it took me close to 2 years. I did have some information that I had collected years prior when I was just curious and wanted to know more about her. Plus, we had little bits in our family history, like the account, a very basic account of when the day she was captured. Mm-hmm. My cousin Michelle White had done some research, and she sent me what she had collected, just the process of contacting as many historical places, you know, museums and societies in that area that may have information on her. And that was included Kansas and Texas, and even Oklahoma because of the Ouachita Massacre. Mm-hmm. I read books that had accounts of her captivity and rescue, and I took notes from each one. I photocopied page after page if my hand got tired. Like, I read Custer's My Life on the Plains because he talks about it extensively. Mm-hmm. Lewis Craft, his book regarding Custer's winter campaign with the Southern Cheyenne, it was crucial, and that book helped me put things into real clear perspective as to the directions they traveled and that sort of thing. It kind of just, because it was chaos, you know, all of that information to read through. It was painstaking in trying to compile it into something that was organized. I call it organized chaos. Just when I had things that I thought were in order, there would always be something that came up and confused things. And so then I would have to investigate those leads and, like, debunk things, clarify facts. It was like going down different rabbit holes. And all I can say is email. Thank God for email, because that was really the most expedient method to communicate and get information, because I couldn't afford to travel to those other states for the information to go every place I needed to go.
But you did end up visiting Kansas and the area and to see, and then you got pictures of those.
Yeah, and then the latter part of the trip was Wheeler, Texas, Ouachita Battlefield in Oklahoma, and then into Kansas. And that portion of the trip was to go to the places like near Wheeler, Texas, where she was rescued, where her and Anna were rescued, to Ouachita National Battlefield, because during the Black Kettle Massacre, they were there. Mm-hmm. They were part of Black Kettle's nephew's band that was a few miles away. And so that was really, you know, I needed to go and experience that place. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, going up into Delphus and going to Anna's and Ira's grave site, and then going and meeting Susie, who's the director of tourism of Cloud County there in Concordia, who's actually related to Sarah as well. Meeting family was really a lot of fun, and forging those bonds. But she took us out to Sarah's grave because it had rained and it was just too, you know, hard to get to on a motorcycle. So she actually took us out there to the grave site so I could get photographs, and mm-hmm. and then I, you know, went around the area and went to Jamestown to get Ben and Mary's grave and all of that. So that's how I, you know, got those pictures. Is it was, if it wasn't for my husband taking me, it would have been really hard to get those. But it I think it helps add a level to the book of putting the faces to the names and making these people real to the reader. And that was really important for me.
What part of the book did you have the hardest time writing?
Organizing the facts. Like I said, it was, I'm not a biographer. I find it easier to make up characters and storylines, places and names, you know, in a romance than working on a historical biography, because the pressure to get things correct is really daunting and stressful. I'm not real good. My mind kind of gets, you know, I wouldn't say the word fractured, but it just gets fragmented. Like, you think you have it all organized, mm-hmm. and then you're going through and you forget something crucial or something else comes up and you got to go down that rabbit hole. It confuses things, and it was really difficult for me to put everything together. I can't say that I got Sarah and Anna's story 100% correct, but I did the best I could with the information that was available to me.
What part of the book was the most fun to write?
Even though it was stressful and frustrating and even scary at times, because I have like a nagging self-doubt about my abilities, that always factors into whatever I'm doing. The fact that I was bringing their story to life and presenting it in a way that the truth was told, and the truth from both sides. You know, there's so many accounts written in the day of the negativity directed towards the Native populace and how they were treated. And that's not fair to them because, you know, we were encroaching on their territory, mm-hmm. and they were doing what any of us would do if we were invaded. We fight for our very way of life and culture, you know, and so that's all they were doing, you know, it was that. It was just very important for me to get the truth out as best I could.
So your research was about 2 years. Once you got the book completed, how long did that take you to write it?
Well, I began writing it like end of June, beginning of July. And it took me like 8 months. I was hoping it wouldn't take that long. Like I said, there was those rabbit holes
right.
when things would pop up. Like dates weren't jiving. Like, wait a minute. If Ben left to go to California with that other group of men and relations for, you know, because of gold fever, it was basically the way they had the dates was that doesn't make any sense. Because if he left in 1849, then Sarah wasn't his. So she was born in December of 1850, so somebody meant to put March of 1850, you know, you have to do the math, you know, and figure those things out. Yeah, those little details like that, or like with her schooling, you know, where did she get her education mm-hmm. for being a teacher? Mm-hmm. And trying to, you know, with the interview with her daughter, I believe it was Della, who said, oh, yeah, we're very proud of her. She got a full scholarship to this school. You go looking into that, and there was no such school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, okay, wait a minute. Somebody's got her memory wasn't serving her correctly, or there's some misinformation there. And so I had to dive down into that and contact university archives and just every place that I could think of. And the only place that ever lined up that made sense for her to attend a school for teaching was at the Fayette Academy, which made sense because, well, while she was 15, 20 miles away or 20, 30 miles away, she had an uncle that lived 4 miles away from the academy. But yet they had boarding, so she could live there. And if she got a full scholarship, that would cover that. They had two different types of degrees, and one was teaching and one was mathematics. Well, she wanted to be a teacher. So to have Fayette Academy that was founded by Mr. Parkinson in Fayette, to me, it just logically, that's where she got her education. None of the other schools that were mentioned, she was not on the roster. She was not listed. There was no such school. So, yeah, it's those rabbit holes. It took forever to investigate those and hear back. And that was frustrating when you're trying to get everything written and get this done. Because I wanted to set a deadline for myself because I'm a huge procrastinator. I needed to, like, okay, I want to have this submitted to my publisher by this date. And I did basically succeed in that. So I'm proud of myself on that one.
If you can meet your characters, what would you say to them today?
I would just thank Sarah for being such a strong and remarkable woman. As for Anna, she did not have it easy after her return. And I would just tell her that I admire and respect her and her choices that she was forced to make, and that I'm sorry that life was so hard for her after her rescue, and that I can identify and empathize.
What is your schedule like when you're writing a book?
I was fortunate that at my job, I worked at a tax office, and I was like 90% of the time I was the only one in the office. So after I had my work done, I had time that I could actually do some research and actually do some writing, because I knew that, yeah, I get interrupted by a phone call, but it wasn't, you know, it was totally different aspect and different side of my brain that I was using than than being creative. So I learned how to manage that, and that's actually where the book was written, was at my job.
And if your book was made into a movie, which actors would play your characters?
Oh, that's, you know, that's a really hard one. I haven't really thought too much about which actors would play what, you know, who in this. There is one actor that I know who would make a really good Custer, because Custer was very egotistical and kind of just charismatic. And Jonathan Scarf, he's really good, and he was in the TV show Hell on Wheels as the bad guy Sidney Snow, and he would be good at that. I would love for my favorite actor Anson Mount to be able to be involved in some way. He was in that same show as the star, and he can just, you know, morph into whoever, and he's very talented, and I would love to be able to, you know, work with him on this in some capacity. As far as a native actor, Michael Gray Eyes, he's one of my top contenders for a part. I think it's because he did play Anna's love interest in a movie in the 90s that was very loosely based on this whole account. He could be one of the older chiefs now in it, that was held captive by Custer. So he would be really good for that. When I was writing this, I kept picturing, because she was interviewed by a reporter, and she gave out very few interviews. And I have a friend who I've known since his days in Chicago at Medieval Times, and he now lives in California. His name is William Hainsworth, and he would be perfect for the reporter, because he just has that kind of look. It's like he could time travel, and he would be perfect for interviewing Sarah. I do know who I would like to be involved in writing and directing, like writing the screenplay and directing it, and that would be John Fusco. He has a huge respect for the Native population. I know that he would lend a great deal of authenticity and honesty to the project, and he does have a copy of the book. I mailed it to him. My brother is friends with him, and so I'm, you know, putting out to the universe, like, this would be a great idea. John, pick up a new project. So I do have hopes, and I would love for him to pick it up and do something with it. Those are basically the only things that, as far as, like, each individual person, I think I'd leave that up to the director and them. They know better. But I would have a say in it.
I'm Tamara Wallace talking with Beth Lynn White from Tombstone, Arizona. We've learned about the process of writing her book, Captured, The True Account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne. On that note, we're going to take a short break, but we will be right back, and we will learn about the first part of her book. I'm Tamara Wallace visiting with Beth Lynn White from Tombstone, Arizona. We have learned about the process of writing her book, Captured, The True Account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne. Now we're going to find out about the first part of her book. Beth Lynn, tell us about Sarah growing up in Wisconsin.
Well, Sarah grew up in Elk Grove Township, which is near Belmont, Wisconsin. Then initially they lived, I think, in like a boarding house that was built not too far away on Bethel Grove Road. But eventually Ben built a nice brick house. And it was, you know, fancy when you consider what they eventually built in Kansas, which was a cabin. That house was torn down in 2015 by the current owners because it fell into disrepair. And what's really nice is they gifted me with a brick from that home. So I do have a brick from that actual house. I don't want to give away too much about the book's content for the listeners, but I will, like, touch on the highlights here. Ben had a bit of a wanderlust. So he wanted to go. He conceived Sarah with his wife, and then he left for the gold rush in California. Well, that didn't work out, and he ended up going across Panama Canal and coming back up on a boat up the Mississippi and came home. But due to the fact that Sarah's brother Richard was killed in the Civil War, I think it had to do with wanting to escape those memories, you know, as to why they relocated out of Belmont. Now, she would have had a great childhood. I've been to where that house was. There's a creek running through there. It was very peaceful. You know, it would have been basically an idyllic type childhood. You know, yeah, you had your chores and you did things, but she would have had free time and could relax, you know, and be a young girl, you know, with a good childhood. But always was looking for something better. And so he had a brother in Effingham, Kansas. So he just decided to uproot the family and move.
Tell us about those travels to his brother in Effingham.
Yeah, it was fraught with a lot of difficulties because with it being spring and then the ground thawed, the wagons, they were heavy laden, and they got bogged down in the mud. So they ended up having to load the wagons with their belongings onto a train and travel that way. Now, Mary and the kids, he only went with his boys, his older boys. So Mary was with Sarah and the rest of the kids still back in Belmont, and they eventually traveled to meet him. You know, they traveled by train to meet him in Effingham, and then they decided to continue on their journey. They were going to go to Nebraska, and his brother said, no, all the good land's taken. Don't go there. Go to the Republican River Valley in Kansas. That's very fertile ground. That'll, you know, be a really good spot to set up a homestead. And so that's where they settled. Unbeknownst to them, for a few years, it was like in 1860, so like about 6 years prior to the a lot of the settlers arriving in Cloud County, there was one gentleman who had settled, and he was warned by the native warriors there to not settle west of Wolf Creek. Now, Wolf Creek was named after a gentleman who built a dugout-type home in the banks there. His last name was Wolf, I believe. And so they got along with him, and they said, but nobody can settle west of that because that was their hunting grounds and their sacred holy grounds. And they said that they would kill anyone who settled west of Wolf Creek. Well, then he just said he was not afraid of any Indians. So he moved, him and his family moved, and they set up a homestead there west of Wolf Creek. And, you know, just they built their cabin, and they just carved a living out by sheer muscle and grit. And it was a crude cabin compared to that brick house. But it was unique in the fact that it was like two cabins with like a summer kitchen area in between. And an image of that, an artist's depiction, is on the back cover of the book, as well as in the book, depicting what that cabin probably most likely looked like. And so, you know, Sarah, having received her teaching degree, she wanted to get and obtain a school in that area to teach at. But it was difficult. You know, again, like I said about her education, trying to find out where she was educated, but it did narrow it down. But, yeah, so they settled and just went about their life as best they could, raising livestock and getting things set up through for the winters and raising their family.
And tell us a little bit about when Sarah's dad and her brothers, they traveled 7 miles away to cut hay.
Yeah, well, they weren't the only ones having to do that because it had been a really, really dry year. And so there was a lot of crop failure, you know, closer to where the homesteads were. The only fertile ground for making hay was along the riverbank. So they all, you know, there was encampment in different areas of men that came to cut hay. And so Ben went with his sons, Martin, John, and Charlie. They took four horses. There was two draft and then two riding horses. And they were in their camp, and they were busy cutting hay, and it was they had to be able to feed their stock through the winter, so that mm-hmm. they were there for some time. And it was the day that Ben was killed and Sarah was captured. They all saw Indians approach, mm-hmm. And they were taking the ponies. They left the draft. They just wanted the more the riding type mm-hmm. horses. Mm-hmm. Ben thought that they were Pawnee, and mm-hmm. that I can reason with them. You know, give them something else to in order exchange for give the ponies back. Mm-hmm. What he didn't realize is that they were Cheyenne dog soldiers, and they were on a raiding mission, mm-hmm. and which. Many of them would do. They had their main encampment, but there was groups that would go out on raiding missions, and they took Ben's life that day.
Mm-hmm. And that same day, that's when Sarah was captured at their cabin.
And being so far away, they didn't know what was happening to either side. You know, Ben didn't know what was happening to his wife and children, nor did Mary and Sarah mm-hmm. and the others know what was happening to Ben and the brothers. They had no idea. So they were going about their day as normal, finishing mm-hmm. up their chores, going in the house mm-hmm. to make breakfast. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're hearing, can you just imagine? Mm-hmm. Beautiful day. You're just going about your business. It's, all of a sudden you hear on the wind Indian war cries. Mm-hmm. Now, that would send chills up anybody's spine.
Right.
And then when you see natives peering in your windows and then bust into the cabin and start pillaging and taking whatever it was that they wanted and demanding food, which they gave them, like, eat, hoping that they would leave. Mm-hmm. They all tried to leave, but they grabbed Sarah back. And it was later on that Sarah had remembered that she recognized one of the Braves as one of the Indians at the trading post that wanted to buy her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she went with her father one day, and he told him mm-hmm. no and whisked mm-hmm. her home as fast as he could. So they knew that the men were away and it would be easy pickings. So her misadventure began that morning with the raid of the cabin.
I'm Tamara Wallace talking with Beth Lynn White from Tombstone, Arizona. We have learned about the first part of the book, Captured, the true account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we will learn about the last part of her book. Back on the front porch, I'm Tamara Wallace visiting with Beth Lynn White from Tombstone, Arizona. We have learned about the first part of her book, Captured, the true account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne. Now we are going to find out about the last part of the book. Beth Lynn, in the last segment, you talked about Sarah being captured by the Cheyenne. Tell us about Anna Brewster Morgan.
All right. Anna Brewster Morgan, she was a newlywed when she was married. She was 19 years of age. She was captured by a band of Sioux warriors who shot her husband, James. As they traveled, they met up with the band of Cheyenne that had captured Sarah and traded ponies for, they wanted mm-hmm. ponies, and they gave Anna to them. When Anna arrived in the camp, she saw Sarah and went up to her and tried to speak to her, but Sarah was not speaking at this point because mm-hmm. of the trauma that she sustained from the repeated assaults. Mm-hmm. Anna then became very protective of Sarah and was able to get her into a feeling of comfort with her that she did regain her speech. And they were forced to do some hard labor. They endured beatings, freezing weather with few warm clothes. Anna was a woman who did not like to be told what to do. She was very defiant as to being ordered about as a slave. She didn't like it, and she let her opinion be known at every turn. Eventually, that did garner enough respect on her part. And Sarah became a well-liked member of what they consider a member of the tribe. They gifted her with a dress, a white woman's dress. They actually liked her because she was obedient and quiet and, did what she was told. Although Sarah and Anna did try to escape twice. The first time, they didn't even make plans of where to meet up. So that they just had to go back and resume life until they could figure out where they were going to meet and that sort of thing. But unfortunately, they were recaptured, and then they were separated, not even allowed to converse with each other for a while. And it was during this that, you know, there was a search party being organized. But weeks had gone by by this point, and it was getting lesser of a chance to be able to get them back. But Sarah's little brother, he was only 15, and he rode alone across trackless prairie nearly 100 miles to Fort Riley in order to make a report of her capture and his dad's murder to Colonel Custer. That in itself took a great amount of bravery to do. And the results of his report, it garnered approximately 1,000 farmers from Kansas who volunteered to search with Custer on that campaign to get the to get Sarah and Anna back. Well, that all happened within 6 weeks.
Tell us about Sarah and Anna when they went to Camp Supply in northern Oklahoma.
Well, after, you know, they were rescued, which, you know, it was a long, hard winter. The blizzards and the campaign was bad for everybody on both sides. Sarah got frostbite of the feet. They had stopped at different forts along the way, and you know, they were cleaned up and given proper clothing, fed, and tried to, you know, they were well loved by the soldiers, like, oh, thank God we got them back and that they're going to be okay. But, you know, they still were traumatized, and it was going to take some time for them to reacclimate back into white society. And they did, as they were traveling, and the some of the natives were still captive because they needed to get them back on the reservation. They kind of delighted at times that their former captors were being prodded by the soldiers' bayonets. But they were finally with their families on April 6th in 1869, a few weeks after their rescue. So, you know, it was yet another... After they were returned to white society, there was a whole other set of obstacles that they would have to face then.
Tell us about Sarah's life in Clyde, Kansas, once she returned.
Well, Sarah, she still wanted to teach, but there was some prudish members and wives of the community who were prone to gossip, and they felt that she was not qualified, as she was somehow contaminated, having been, you know, captured by the Indians. Other members felt, well, we're still on the edge of the you know, territory here. They felt it was too risky to have Sarah teach on the edge of the frontier because there were still hostiles on the warpath. And she was basically a marked woman, so she was recaptured, which was typical. It happened quite often. It would not be a good ending for her. So they sent her about 8 miles east of Concordia to Clyde, where she obtained a teaching position, and it was in a primitive log building owned by Erastus Brooks. And he knew all about her capture, and it is, from what I can remember, he did kind of go on, was one of the volunteers who did go for a time on the campaign to look for her. And he fell in love with her. She fell in love with him, and they married and began their life together. And they had 7 children and lived an honest life together.
Now, wasn't there an event in Concordia she went to and she recognized some of the warriors?
I don't know if she recognized the warriors, but Wild Bill and his, or Buffalo Bill and his Wild West show came to Concordia. And, you know, a lot of, I mean, she was 50 years old by this time, so a number of years had passed when that happened. And so it wouldn't be that she recognized, you know, some of the natives, and because they were probably children when she was with the tribe. But she was in the audience, and it, family legend has it that he recognized, Buffalo Bill recognized Sarah. And that he invited her to dinner to talk about her time in captivity, and she blatantly refused him because she didn't want to talk about it. She didn't really talk about it. She confided in her husband, Erastus. She'd confided in her mother previously, but she didn't, like, really give a lot of interviews or anything. So she just got on with life. She was, one of those things, like, no, I'm married, I have children, I'm making a life, that is behind me. I'm not going to dwell on that like Anna did.
Well, this is such a great book, and I know I enjoyed it, and I just, at the end, I said, wow. So tell us how someone can get a copy of your book, Beth Lynn.
Okay, well, it is available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble in both paperback and ebook formats. It can be purchased in person at the Cloud County Historical Museum, and I believe it's at the museum. I know that it's at the Tourism Center there. It's at the Wheeler Historical Museum in Wheeler, Texas, and I think there's some copies at the Ottawa County Historical Museum in Minneapolis, Kansas. It's also available at the Lafayette County Historical Museum in Darlington, Wisconsin, and at Boot Hill Graveyard here in Tombstone.
And I'm Tamara Wallace here on the front porch talking with Beth Lynn White from Tombstone, Arizona. We have learned about her growing up and just a little bit how she got into writing and the book captured the true account of Sarah White and the Cheyenne. Just hit the highlights, so you'll want to make sure you get the book and read it completely. Sarah used her art abilities to design the book cover, as well utilizing a photo she took of her husband's previous house upstairs, wallpaper and images of Sarah she photoshopped into the frame, and a photo she took of the White Cabin from a painting at the Cloud County Historical Museum. I've had the most pleasure speaking with Beth Lynn White. Just an honor to get to visit with her. Thank you, Beth Lynn, for joining us for On the Front Porch, and to all who joined our conversation.
Well, thank you so much for reaching out to me and having this interview. It means a great deal. It's a great honor for me, to be honest. I'm quite humbled by the attention. So, again, I appreciate you reaching out to me and